Revelation chapter 14. Then I looked, and there before me was a Lamb standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000 who had his name and his Father's name written on their foreheads. And I heard a sound from heaven, like the roar of rushing waters, and like a loud peal of thunder. The sound I heard was like that of harpists playing their harps, and they sang a new song before the throne, and before the four living creatures and the elders. No one could learn the song except the 144,000 who had been redeemed from the earth. These are those who did not defile themselves with women, for they kept themselves pure. They followed the Lamb wherever he goes. They were purchased from among men and offered as first fruits to God and the Lamb. No lie was found in their mouths. They are blameless. Then I saw another angel flying in mid-air, and he had the eternal gospel to proclaim to those who live on the earth, to every nation, tribe, language, and people. He said in a loud voice, "Fear God and give him glory, because the hour of his judgment has come. Worship him who made the heavens, the earth, the sea, and the springs of water." A second angel followed and said, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great, which made all the nations drink the maddening wine of her adulteries." A third angel followed them and said in a loud voice, "If anyone worships the beast and his image and receives his mark on the forehead or on the hand, he too will drink of the wine of God's fury, which has been poured full strength into the cup of his wrath. He will be tormented with burning sulfur in the presence of the holy angels and of the Lamb, and the smoke of their torment rises forever and ever. There is no rest day or night for those who worship the beast and his image, or for anyone who receives the mark of his name. This calls for patient endurance on the part of the saints who obey God's commandments and remain faithful to Jesus." Then I heard a voice from heaven say, "Write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on." "Yes," says the Spirit, "they will rest from their labour, for their deeds will follow them." I looked, and there before me was a white cloud, and seated on the cloud was one like a son of man, with a crown of gold on his head and a sharp sickle in his hand. Then another angel came out of the temple and called in a loud voice to him who was sitting on the cloud, "Take your sickle and reap, because the time to reap has come, for the harvest of the earth is ripe." So he who was seated on the cloud swung his sickle over the earth, and the earth was harvested. Another angel came out of the temple in heaven, and he too had a sharp sickle. Still another angel, who had charge of the fire, came from the altar and called in a loud voice to him who had the sharp sickle, "Take your sharp sickle and gather the clusters of grapes from the earth's vine, because its grapes are ripe." The angel swung his sickle on the earth, gathered its grapes, and threw them into the great winepress of God's wrath. They were trampled in the winepress outside the city, and blood flowed out of the press, rising as high as the horses' bridles for a distance of 1,600 stadia.
On July the 8th, 1741, a little town called Enfield in Connecticut in the US, a famous Christian preacher called Jonathan Edwards preached a sermon entitled "Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God." And it conjures up all sorts of images of God dangling sinners by a single thread over the fires of hell. It's probably the best known hellfire and brimstone sermon in all of history, except maybe for Jesus. It's been very popular in past centuries. It was printed and reprinted and reprinted, distributed around the world. And preachers used it and similar sermons to try and terrify people into converting. It's been sent up in the movies, that pulpit thumping, shouting preacher cajoling people to turn or burn, really is based on Jonathan Edwards. But today, of course, we're too polite, aren't we? We're too civilised, we're too user-friendly to ever indulge in such barbarity. Besides, if we think that Scream and Alien and Psycho are entertainment, is there anything that will actually frighten us anyway? Well, Revelation 14, this last chapter we're coming to this semester, includes some hellfire and brimstone. In fact, this is the chapter in the Bible that the term hellfire and brimstone comes from. In verse 10, they'll be tormented with burning sulphur. Old translations, burning brimstone, in the presence of the holy angels and of the Lamb. Well, today we'll include some hellfire and brimstone, because God gives us some home truths about the final judgment that he wants us to know and understand. Before the judgment comes in this chapter, God fires some warning shots over our bows. In verses 6 to 13, three angels with three messages come. These messages are for the whole world, for every people group. Black, white, rich, poor, a relevant, urgent message for every single person in the world, no matter whether you're educated or not, blonde hair, blue eyes, brown hair, yellow eyes, whatever you might be, this is a message for you. The first angel in verse 7 says, "Fear God and give him glory, because the hour of his judgment has come. Worship him who made the heavens, the earth, the sea, and the springs of water." This is the eternal gospel, not all the gospel, but always the gospel. Not the full gospel, because that's about Jesus, but foundational. And the gospel is fear God, give him honour and thanks, and worship him. That is, treat God as God. Why? Because he made everything. He made the sun, the moon, the stars, the earth, the heavens. He made the rivers. He made everything. Which means he made us. We're dependent on him for all that we are. He owns us. And secondly, because his judgment is coming. We're accountable to the one who made us, who owns us, who gave us life. If you don't get that, let me try and give you an illustration. Imagine that you're a parent with a teenage son or daughter. No, maybe 18, 19, first year uni. You've got a child like that, okay? And they live in your house. And they enjoy everything you provide for them. You put a meal out, they eat it, they love it. They leave their washing out for you to do and the ironing for you to do and put back in their room again. And, well, they just treat your place like a hotel, the best hotel in the world. But they treat you, their parents, the ones who provide the meals, who do the washing, do the ironing, they treat you like a block of wood. In fact, they ignore you the whole time. Now, imagine you're that parent. Would you be happy? I wouldn't. I don't think you would either, would you? What would you do? I presume you'd say, wake up to yourself. This can't go on. Either it's going to change or the situation will change. You need to change. There's going to be a day of reckoning, a day of judgment. Well, that's really what God says. We live in his world. We enjoy everything he provides. He says, stop ignoring me. Don't treat me like a block of wood. Honour God as God. Treat him as God. Because if you don't, there's going to be a day of reckoning. This can't go on forever and ever and ever. It's going to stop one way, one day. Angel 2 has got a different message. Fallen, verse 8. Fallen is Babylon the Great, which made all the nations drink the maddening wine of her adulteries. The background to this is chapters 12 and 13, where, if you've been here the last couple of weeks, we've seen Satan in the form of a dragon. He's been defeated by the blood of the Lamb in heaven. He's thrown down to earth. But on earth, it's sort of his last fling. He knows his time is short, but he's going to make the most of it by making war against God's people. And he operates through these two beasts, beast one, beast two. Beast one is the political power that some people exercise in this world. Beast two is false religion. They team up, and most people go along with it. If getting ahead requires a bit of bowing and scraping, well, that's what they do to get ahead. B1 is called Babylon. It's code in the first century for Rome, the superpower. And God says Babylon is fallen. What you think of as permanent and powerful, its end is nigh. It's doomed. God will demolish Babylon. Then Angel 3 tells us what's going to happen after that. If anyone, verse 9, worships the beast and its image and receives its mark on their forehead or their hand, they too will drink the wine of God's fury, which has been poured full strength in the cup of his wrath. It's the warning that all who go along with the beast, with Babylon, if they give their allegiance and worship to the beast, then they will suffer the consequences. They'll drink the wine of God's fury, the cup of God's wrath. The image is one of pouring wine into a goblet, a cup, and it's full strength. In those days, full strength wine was 15 to 20%. Most of it tasted vile. and it was so strong that it would send you reeling. Most people, when they drank wine, would cut it down a bit, water it down to make it palatable. But this is saying God will force them to drink this vile wine, full strength, leaving you staggering around, drink it all the way to the dregs, with that bitter aftertaste left in your mouth. Verses 10b and 11 make that a bit more explicit. They'll be tormented with burning sulphur in the presence of the holy angels and his Lamb, and the smoke of their torment will rise forever and ever. There'll be no rest day or night for those who worship the beast and its image, or for anyone who receives the mark of its name. Tormented with burning sulphur, though, the picture comes from volcanic activity, that searing heat and pungent odour. But it's picture language of pain and suffering that never ends. The smoke keeps rising forever. There's no rest. There'll be an eternal restlessness. They can't relax. Never comfortable. Always in pain. These three warning shots God fires across the bows of every person on planet Earth. Angel 1, God's judgment is coming. Angel 3, that's why you should take God seriously. And then John sees the actual judgment happening in verses 14 to 20. And it's pictured as a harvest. And the harvest has two runs. The first run is like harvesting grain, wheat or corn or something like that. The second run is like harvesting grapes. The judge, the harvester, is described in verse 14 as somebody seated on the cloud like a son of man with a crown of gold on his head and a sharp sickle in his hand. If you know the background, you know this is Jesus himself, now with a crown of gold on his head. But he's got a sickle in his hand. The sickle is the old-fashioned way of doing harvesting. These days we've got headers and mechanised things like that. Well, that was a very efficient way, very effective, but not very efficient way of doing harvesting, this sharp sickle. And Jesus is told that it's time for harvest. The angel announces that the grain is ripe. The harvest has been waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting. But the judgment won't come till the time is right, till the grapes and the wheat is ripe. And the results are seen in verses 19 and 20. The angel swung his sickle on the earth, gathered the grapes and threw them into the great winepress of God's wrath. They were trampled in the winepress outside the city, and blood flowed out of the press, rising as high as the horses' bridles for a distance of 1,600 stadia. The picture is of grapes being all collected and then thrown into the huge winepress where the harvester is treading out the grapes and the juice is flowing. And normally that would be party atmosphere, but this is no party. They're being trampled in anger, and the blood flows like the grape juice would have flown. And the blood is 2 metres deep and it runs for 300 kilometres. That's as far as here to Augusta, of blood flowing, a river of blood, the length of Palestine, rising, flowing, its stomach churning, if you can imagine it. And John paints this graphic picture of judgment, not impersonal judgment, but God's wrath, God's anger being poured out, a picture of hell. There's no pulpit thumping. There's no shouting. He just asks us to picture it. And the images have their impact, don't they? You can't read this and use your imagination without it being burned into your mind, burned into your memory. But we've skipped over verses 1 to 5. In verses 1 to 5, John has already painted a very, very different picture of the future of some of humanity. Verse 1, I looked and there before me was the Lamb standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000 who had his name and his Father's name written on their foreheads. This is a different picture. Here's Jesus, the Lamb, not with a sickle now, but the Lamb who gave his life for us, alive, standing on Mount Zion, on God's sanctuary, and with him are 144,000 people. Who are these 144,000? Well, we met them back in chapter 7. Sorry, you may not have met them. If you were here 3 years ago, I think it was, when we did chapter 7 in our CU public meeting, we met these 144,000. They come again here in chapter 14. Now, 144,000, as we explored then, is a sort of very roundish number, isn't it? A very suggestive number. It's 12 times 12 times 1,000. And 12 in the Bible is normally the number that represents God's people, the 12 tribes, the 12 apostles. Here it's 12 times 12 times 1,000. Now, it is possible that John is thinking that it's not 143,999, it's not 144,001, it's exactly 144,000 people. But I doubt it, actually. I think it is symbolic of all God's people of all time. And we know that that's too many to count from the second half of chapter 7. And yet, even though it's too many to count, there is an exact number, the right number, every one of them known, counted, not one of them is missing. And these 144,000, instead of having the brand of the beast on their forehead or on their hand, they've got the name of the Lamb and the name of God on their forehead. Against all the pressures to give allegiance to the beast, to burn incense to Caesar as God, to bow to the state's demand to be a Muslim or an atheist, whatever it might be today, they haven't committed adultery by worshipping something that is not a god. They have stood firm following the Lamb. And they're marked then with the Lamb's name, which has both the sense of belonging, they belong to the Lamb, but also of protection. The Lamb has put his name on them. He will protect them. Because they belong to him, no harm will come to them. And suddenly it all goes musical. Did you notice that? There's all sorts of sounds, loud, exuberant sounds, rushing waters, thunders, even harps. I don't know whether you like harps or not. I don't like them particularly, but I've never heard a harp that sounds like thunder. Have you? I'm not quite sure what to make of this. But the thing is not the music so much, it's the singing. Because the 144,000 break into song. There's no singing about Babylon, but this 144,000, they can't help singing. And they sing a song of redemption. And we're told that no one else can sing that song. The angels can't sing it, because the angels haven't been redeemed. It's the 144,000, they can sing it, because they have experienced redemption. They know that they're in a great predicament. They know that they've been purchased at great cost. And when you know that, what do? Well, I guess you could throw a party. You could sit down with your iPad and just watch a movie, but wouldn't you break out in song? Wouldn't you celebrate? You couldn't keep that in, could you? And that's what it's like for these 144,000. That experience of not just being redeemed, but now being safe, protected for all eternity, leads them to sin. We're told they haven't lied. When somebody put a sword against their neck and said, "Bow to Caesar or else," and they thought, well, I could just bow to Caesar. I could just tell a little lie and no one will really know. God will forgive me. They didn't do it. They stood true to what they knew was true. That Jesus was the Lord God. That he had purchased them by his blood. And their final destiny is not wrath, but salvation, safety, rest forever. Well, this chapter talks about judgment, torment and hell. And it's not very pleasant, is it? In fact, for many people, it's distasteful, even immoral. A friend of mine said to me last week, one of the things I just don't get about Christianity, one of the things I hate about Christianity, is this idea that God sends people to hell forever. Like, where's the good in that? That's not restorative. It's got no restorative value whatsoever. It's just vindictive and petty and mean. Feel like that sometimes? Well, if so, let's think about it a little bit more. Let's explore this and try and make some sense of it with a little bit more depth and not trivialise it. I want to ask two broader questions. What do we do about evil? And what's this eternal torment? Why eternal? Firstly, what to do about evil? We live in a world in which evil happens. I don't know anyone who denies that. People do stuff they shouldn't do. Isn't that right? It's in the newspapers every day. What should we do about that? What do you want God to do about it? Well, criminologists and philosophers and politicians and lawyers normally delineate three ways of dealing with criminals. It's there on your outline: deterrence, treatment, or retribution. See, if I steal Malcolm's phone, I get his phone, his beloved, precious iPhone, whatever he's got, I just steal it from him, sneak up beside him, get him out of his pocket, and then throw it on the ground and crunch it and wreck it. Now, that's wrong. I shouldn't do it, should I? Now, what should you do to me? Well, there's three different ways of thinking about it. You could say, what we should do to Tim is deter. That is, we want to treat Tim in a way that will deter him from doing it again and deter others from doing it. Get the idea? That's a deterrent. And so you might lock me up because that'll stop me doing it again. You might cut my hands off because that'll stop me pinching people's phones, probably, unless my toes are very dexterous. You might fine me and hope that that would be enough to deter me, and then you'd publicise that. You'd put it on the UWA website. Tim Thorburn got fined $10,000 for stealing Malcolm's phone, and you think, I'm not going to steal anybody's phone. Works, doesn't it? Deterrence. Or you could think of it as treatment, of rehabilitation. So you say, well, Tim, what you've done is really bad. You're sick, really. And we want to re-educate you. We want to rehabilitate you so that you'll become a good citizen. So we'll do something to change your behaviour, to make you not what you were, but something that you should be. Or retribution. You could punish me for the crime. You can say, Tim, that was a naughty thing to do. Shouldn't have done it. We'll punish you commensurate with the crime. We'll make you buy Malcolm a new phone and pay for a year airtime so we can use it. So that's some sort of punishment against me. He gets restituted. We call it quits at that. Now, notice the first two, deterrence and treatment, look forward. You're trying to create a better situation out of a bad one. The third one, retribution, looks backwards. It says, look at what they've done. Let's treat them according to what they've done. Now, these three are popular in different ways. Deterrence is usually what comes up at election time. Whatever people want to be elected to government, they say, we've got to be tougher on crime because then we can keep crime down. We can reduce crime by deterring, by being really tough. And other people say, well, I won't do it then because it's too tough. Treatment is what most of our criminologists actually think at the moment. So in WA, we have the corrective services, which is treatment, isn't it? We're correcting people. We're not punishing them. We're not deterring them. We're trying to correct them. And retribution is usually what most of the victims want. Well, which one is better? Which is more humane? Well, it seems like deterrence and treatment seem to have the good of society and the good of the criminal in view, don't they? They sound so much better, so much more civilised, so much more humane. This year is the 50th anniversary of C.S. Lewis's death. And if you don't know, C.S. Lewis was the Narnia guy. You know C.S. Lewis? We did a couple of things a few weeks ago about Lewis. Lewis, as well as writing fantasy fiction and writing Christian apologetics, also wrote some stuff which you could call social activism. And in 1949, he wrote a paper, entitled The Humanitarian Theory of Punishment. And he argued in that paper that deterrence and treatment, although they look very humane, inevitably become very inhumane and oppressive. And he wanted to argue that retribution ought to be the way we think about treating criminals. His argument went a bit like this. Imagine, take deterrence for example. If the principle you work on is deterrence, that is, the question you ask is, does it deter people from doing wrong? Well, think where that goes. You want to deter me from pinching Malcolm's phone and everyone else in this room from pinching Malcolm's phone. What would you do? What would be effective? Well, the most effective thing is firstly, even before I've done anything, stop me doing it. If you can imagine that maybe I might have a temptation, a thought in my mind to pinch Malcolm's phone, what will you do to deter me? You'll lock me up in prison. And as long as you think that thought might be in my head, you'll keep me in prison. All this week, all next year, all next decade. And that will act as a very good deterrent, won't it? And if you see me put in prison forever, it will deter you really well, won't it? And it'll be completely unjust and inhumane and immoral to do that to me. But if that's the only question you ask, that's where you end up. That's why, back in the 1700s, they shipped thousands of people to Australia for stealing handkerchiefs or loaves of bread. It was a deterrent. Well, it was actually a way of the upper classes keeping the underclasses in check. It was really a form of class warfare. It was immoral. But if that's the way you go, that's where you get. What about treatment? If we treat people as sick, we detain them. Well, how long do you detain them for then? Well, you detain them till they're cured. So I steal Malcolm's phone. You say, well, Tim, that's not criminal. That's just a bit sick. You don't really know what you're doing. You're not really responsible. So all we need to do is treat you, re-educate you, rehabilitate you till you're a good citizen and you don't keep thinking about stealing people's phones. Well, again, how long will that take? What is justifiable? Well, any treatment is justifiable if it's going to work. Lobotomy? Yep, that could work. Why not do it if that's your only question? What will rehabilitate them? That's on that basis that the Soviet gulags were formed. Cambodia had their re-education camps, and they become bywords of cruelty and immorality. Now, Lewis says retribution is actually the only one that treats people as humans, people made in the image of God who ought to know better, rather than treating them as sick animals or imbeciles. And therefore, we punish them as they deserve. He's not saying retribution alone, but he's saying that unless you have retribution as your basis, deterrence and treatment will become inhumane and cruel. Yes, with retribution, have deterrence. It works as a deterrent. And you can rehabilitate people. But fundamentally, he says, we need to do retribution. Interestingly, 25 years after Lewis wrote, an Australian guy called Barton Babbage wrote a follow-up article in which he surveyed the academic discussions about Lewis's article and the practical outworkings. And he finishes the article by referring to a report that came out of the San Francisco prison system just before he wrote the article. It was a report that particularly looked at the effect of the imprisonment on the prisoners. Now, California at that point was at the vanguard, the forefront of new ways, humane ways of thinking about what to do to criminals. They called their prisons adjustment centres. That says something, doesn't it? Adjustment centres. We will adjust you. And the prisoners themselves report how inhumane it was. Let me read you some of what the report said. The persistent branding of lawbreakers as sick or abnormal is a mask to hide the mixture of hatred, fear, revulsion that white middle-class reformers feel for persons who don't share their middle-class ethic. The purpose of treatment is to force conformity to this ethic. From the convict's point of view, treatment is a humiliating game, the rules of which he must learn in order to placate his keepers and manipulate the parole board at his annual hearing. Anyone who refuses to submit to treatment will find himself diagnosed as a troublemaker and his custody classification will be accordingly maximum. Furthermore, if he declines to play the treatment game, he'll find his incarceration indefinitely prolonged. Not only has treatment failed miserably after decades of experience, but even if it were scientifically feasible, its methods and objectives, manipulative routines for the purpose of remoulding the young, poor, black, brown deviants who fill the prisons to the satisfaction of their middle, white-class, middle-aged captors are offensive and immoral. What do the reports suggest you do? Go back to the tradition of letting the punishment fit the crime. That is, treat them as people, responsible for their action. Afford them the dignity of treating their choices as significant choices, not the non-responsible acts of people who are sick and can't help it. A retribution is the only response that treats people as human. We see in this passage God treating people with retribution, bringing judgment for their crime, for their sin, for their evil. But you might say eternal torment, that doesn't sound right. Does anyone really deserve eternal punishment? In our justice system, even life imprisonment is not usually the rest of their life. It has limited duration. And I feel some sympathy for that. And the thought of my own brother, who's not a Christian, in hell for eternity, sends knives into my heart. Yet it's hard to understand this passage any other way, is it? The smoke of their torment rises forever. Jesus himself said about hell, that is where the worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. Secondly, the severity of the crime. That is, the crime. If the crime needs to fit the punishment, what is the severity of our crime? The Bible does recognise varying degrees of evil and culpability. Jesus himself said it would be more tolerable for Sodom and Gomorrah than for the people of Capernaum on the day of judgment because they're more culpable. Less culpable. But what is it that we've done? What is the worst thing you've done in your life? I take it the worst thing you've done is to break the greatest command. And what's the greatest command? Is it don't steal a phone? Is it don't murder? Now, the greatest command is to love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength. And I break that every day. I've broken it drastically. I've smashed it to pieces. Haven't you? Then that's what I deserve. And the Bible has no hope It doesn't hold out the hope that people in hell will repent. In fact, in chapter 22 of Revelation, it says, those who sin keep on sinning. They will do that forever. They keep singing, I want to do it my way, into eternity. God's judgment. It's called in Isaiah 28 God's alien task, God's strange alien work. Because in one sense it goes against the grain of God, to punish those he loves, to destroy those he created. His proper work is saving. His great project from the beginning of time is heaven, not hell, to rescue rebels like you and me for eternity. And that's clear from this chapter, isn't it? That is, why does God send the warning shots across the bow? Why does he say, everyone listen, turn, treat God as God, because his judgment is coming? Because he cares. When people warn you, it's usually because they care, isn't it? When a mate says to you, come on, it's week 13, the exams are only 11 days away. I guess you could say, I'm offended, you think I'm lazy. No, you are lazy, that's the problem. They're saying it because they care about you. Similarly with God. Why would he warn us? Only because he cares. Only because he'd prefer not to judge us, but instead open his arms and say, won't you turn? Won't you come back to me? Let's pray. Lord God, we thank you for warning us. Please help us not to dismiss your warning, but to take it seriously. In Jesus' name.